So, welcome everybody. And I know there are a couple of you who are a little newer to Ananda. Most of you are not. But for those of you who are, when we actually get started, I'll say a little bit because it's relevant today about our line of teachers. We're going to start with a prayer, and then we'll just do about 5 minutes of meditation before I start. So let's pray together. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Paramahansa Yoganandaji, Saints of all religions, we humbly bow before all of you. Divine Mother, be with us this morning. Open our hearts. Raise our consciousness so that we may receive these divine teachings and use them in this life to allow us to learn those lessons that will help us obtain soul freedom. Om, peace, amen. These chants repeat themselves, so if you don't know the first line, you can listen to Raghu, and then you can repeat it the second time for those of you who may not know it. Let's sit up straight now. Shoulders back and down in a relaxed way. Heart open, focusing our attention at the point between the eyebrows. Let's meditate just for about 5 minutes. Om, peace, amen. For those of you who don't know me, because there are a few people here who don't know me very well, you know my name is Shanti, that you know, and I'm one of the minister's light bearers from up at Ananda Palo Alto. I've been on this particular spiritual path since 1979, a little bit of a miracle story in itself, which might come out later because it's relevant here. What also is relevant is that I happen to be a physician. And it's funny, my life is seamless in that way. And I say it not because I think you need to hear about me, but because any of the stories that I share with you today, how I wound up in medicine, how I wound up at Ananda, many of the stories, I've come to realize they were obviously given to me so that I could share them. But the other thing I realize is that if these things could happen to me, they could happen to anybody. Some of you have already heard me tell this story, but it's so relevant today. I was a nurse for many years before I went back to medical school. Actually loved being a nurse. Can you all hear me? Great. I'm having a fight with a virus, and we're sort of tied right now. I have a lot of good energy, but it has my voice, so... just jumped in on Wednesday night and took my voice away. If you can't hear, please come a little closer. Usually I can project much more than this. Anyway, I went to nursing school when I was 17, right out of high school, to a 3-year program. They don't have them anymore. But in those days, they were very popular. And so I was immediately, actually before I was 20 years old, in very intense medical situations. And I very quickly moved into ICU and CCU nursing. I don't know, it was just called there. And one night, I was working in the intensive care unit. And maybe some of you know, maybe you don't, but the nurses who work in the intensive care units and coronary care units very quickly get to know a lot of medicine. Just happens that way. We become kind of subspecialized. And then when you work in a teaching hospital, the interns and residents who know nothing and who are terrified really come to rely on you, as they should. If they're humble enough, they do anyway. And I was working nights, and I this man who I'd come to know, who I had worked with for maybe a week, maybe more, I honestly don't remember, a patient who was there, suddenly had a cardiac arrest. And so I called what we call a code, and everybody came running, and we were resuscitating this man. And the doctors kept wanting to stop the resuscitation. And I kept having a feeling that we should not stop the resuscitation. And it was such a strong feeling for me that I kept saying to them, we cannot stop. And because of what I just told you, they were afraid, I was not. Even though I knew nothing, they didn't stop. And at one point they said to me, Shanti, his pupils are fixed and dilated. Fixed and dilated means brain dead. And right in that moment, I looked up into the corner of the room. My attention was drawn there. And I see him up in the corner of the room. And he looks at me, and he smiles, and he winks like that with his left eye. So I say to the doctors, we are not stopping this resuscitation. And about 10 minutes later, his heartbeat comes back, and now he's intubated, and you've all seen movies about this, if you haven't seen it live. I mean, it wasn't like he was looking like a rose, but he was alive. We were breathing for him. And the doctors are just sort of looking at me like, how did she know? Well, we still didn't know how compass mentis he was going to be. But the next day I came to work, and I grabbed his hand. I said, hey, John, how are you? And he looked at me, and he smiled, and he winked. It was a very, very powerful experience for me. I remember when things calmed down, I went to the phone. I called my mother. I was living in Washington, D.C., and she was up in Pittsburgh, where I had been born and raised. And I said to her, and I remember this. I mean, I remember it like it was last night. I said to her, Mom, we have no idea what's really going on in this world. I didn't know, you know, this was, let's see, I was 20. It was like 1967. So you realize those were the years. Nobody prior to that, I'm looking around to see who might be old enough to remember this, but we did not talk about death and dying in those days, ever. We didn't only not just talk about it amongst each other, but you never told a patient their diagnosis. They just died if they were going to die. You never said to somebody, you have cancer, or this is what it is. It's pretty unimaginable right now, but it's the way things were. And then, literally, what happened in this world, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was here, a German physician who had come to this country, who was sort of walking around hospitals. She, by the way, was a psychiatrist. And she was saying, this is crazy. And in this way, I'll tell you, Germany, from a medical point of view and a holistic medical point of view, has always been ahead of us. They're way ahead of us right now. You go to a hospital in Germany, and it truly is complementary medicine. It's exactly the kind of medicine that I like to practice now. Not against anything, for whatever it is each individual person needs. Listening to them, knowing that, moving from a place of inspiration and intuition, and figuring out what do they need. Do they need a prescription for penicillin? There's nothing wrong with that. I say to everybody, take it home and put it on your altar. You think God's any less in a capsule of penicillin than he is in this altar? Of course not. There's nothing in this universe that's not manifested from pure divine energy. So I'm not against anything. And Germany really practices that way. But she said, this is really nuts. We really have to start talking to people about death and dying. And a very interesting thing is, the very first person she ever hired to work with her was one of the cleaning ladies in the hospital. And this woman said to her, because she said, I'm going to start a whole hospital for people who have chronic severe illness. And this woman said, why would you want me? I'm a cleaning lady. And Kubler-Ross said to her, no, you're not. I've been watching you for years now. You walk into the room. When you say to somebody, how are you? You actually listen. to their answer. She said, I have watched you do more in terms of healing people than most of the people who come here to work. That woman went on to become her chief, like, administrative assistant from that cleaning woman, because Kubler-Ross could see who she was. But so this was 1967 when I had that experience, and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was just coming on the scenes. Nobody talked about any of this, and I was really completely naive about all of it. And I want to say to you, because again, it matters about how I got to where I am and why I'll speak to you the way I'll speak to you, that I had been born and raised Jewish, and I was very involved in Judaism. I was hungry for it. I insisted that my family keep us close to an Orthodox home as we could, and I studied. I went to what was called the College of Jewish Studies. But again, I had no idea. I was a really rather unconscious young person. I was being helped and driven, but I wasn't conscious. Not like probably if many of you could say you knew from the minute you came in that you had to find God or some path. Not me. Thank you, Doug. And one day I was just sitting in synagogue on Yom Kippur, and I was listening to this rabbi speak, and I said to myself, I don't believe a word this rabbi is saying. He was up there giving us a talk about why the Jews were God's chosen people and always would be. And I said to myself, how could that be? How could a religion be God's chosen people? And then it came to me that I never felt inspired by this rabbi. And so I got up and I left the shul right in the middle of Yom Kippur. One does not do that. And I never went back. Now, I tell you that because I'm segueing into how I walked onto this path and who these masters are and why it matters when we go to talk today about death and dying. Then I became aware of the fact that I needed to find something. It dawned on me why I had been studying Judaism and spending so much time in the synagogue. And there were many reasons, but those aren't important. But this was, I really wanted to know something about God. And I just started a search. I started traveling all over the world, spending time with different masters. And then ultimately, I moved to Leucadia, which is a little town right next to Encinitas, where Paramahansa Yogananda, one of the first places where he came when he came to the United States. And there was this place called Swami's Place. And my husband and I, in our arrogance, used to make fun of it. We say, oh, look at them. They probably know that the mind and body have something to do with each other, because it was called self-realization. So what did we know? We said, look, they know the mind and the body work together because we were both in medicine and we did, but most people in medicine did not at that time. Now, for those of you who don't know, it turns out that Paramahansa Yogananda, who came to this country in 1920 when he was in his early 20s, is what we call an avatar. And an avatar is a being who is born because there are souls that are calling to these completed souls, these people who have realized their oneness with the divine. And those of us who haven't, and we need some help, when we call loud enough and we mean it enough, one of these great souls, highly evolved souls, literally takes a body and comes to be with us. And that happens. It's not about a religion. Jesus did that when the Jews needed him 2015 years ago. He was a rabbi, and he came to say to the Jews, you guys are in trouble. You're really God-loving people, but you need some help. You've gotten lost. Now, the Jews couldn't hear him, which is rather unfortunate. They're still putting out a cup of wine at Passover waiting for Elijah, but there you have it. It just wasn't theirs to know then. And it happened when Krishna came and when Buddha came, and it happened when Yogananda came. Now, these are not the only ones, but I'm saying that. I had no idea about that. But miracles started happening in my life. And the first miracle was that one day while I was running under the Encinitas Hermitage, I was literally stopped in my tracks, literally, and I heard I didn't know about these things. I knew nothing. But it came to me in a way that I would never doubt. You're going to go to medical school, Shanti. And not only that, but you have to go to an Ivy League medical school because you'll practice in unusual ways and you need to have some credibility. And I just went home and I said to my husband, you won't believe this, I'm going to medical school and I have to go to an Ivy League school. And God bless him, he said, okay, what do we do? Just like that, without a beat's pause. So I want you to hear the stories, not because I need you to hear about me. I'm telling you about them. I could no more have made that happen. I didn't even know what was going on, which is the other important part of my telling you some of these stories. We have no idea what's going on. None. We think we're in charge of these lives. We think we make decisions. We think any of that happens. No way. Last week or the week before, I was going to give this sermon at the Sunday service. And the day before on Saturday, I was leading a hike of about 25 people. We got to the top of this hike, all in on to people. We were going to sit and chant and meditate. And so I said, who has their iPhone? Who can play a chant? Everybody pulled out their iPhone, of course. And I wanted to hear a song that was, who is in my temple? Because it felt like a temple where we had come. But I said to myself, don't say it. Let everybody else say what they want. So I was leading the hike. But I kept praying for it. But that's not what happened. Nobody else wanted to hear that song. That night I went home. I was preparing for the service. And I said, I'm going to play it. But I'm not very good on the harmonium. And it wasn't doing what it needed to do. So I said, I'll play my next favorite chant. My next favorite's not even a chant. Twameva Mata. It's like a call to God. We do it before we chant. I go into Sunday service the next day. Janice Fairley, who some of you may know from here, was leading the chanting. We all walk out onto the dais. What two chants does she play? Who is in my temple? And Twameva Mata. And I got up to give the sermon and I said, Janice actually thought that she made that decision last night. She actually thought that she chose those chants. She had no idea. We have no idea. And I'm going to make this relevant to this whole topic of death and dying. It looks like we're in charge of things. It looks that way. And what does it mean to us when somebody says, as these great masters say, and we get to hear it, I started to say to you before, right from an avatar. Because this whole path was blessed with Swami Kriyananda, who spent the last 3.5 years of Yogananda's life with him. So he hears right from, he hears the truth as only an avatar, only somebody who's experienced the truth, only somebody who can do these things that these people do, levitate, walk on water, bilocate, raise the dead, all these things that really happen. Who could do that? Could we do that? I mean, maybe some of you can. I don't want to be pretentious. But I've been on this spiritual path for 40 years now. I've been meditating, studying, praying, chanting. I live in community. I'm working hard at it. Now, it's just me. And I realize I shouldn't even say I'm a limited being master. Wouldn't be happy about that. But of course I am. And I mean it really, maybe some of you, certainly you're not limited in the same ways I am. But most of us probably couldn't bilocate or raise the dead. Or when one of our devotees or students gets upset that we're gone, 3 days later, reappear in our human body and be there. Not just Christ, but Sri Yukteswar, the story in autobiography. So here we have a teacher who knows the truth, who's come back many times, who remembers his life, who actually remembers our lives, past lives, though he's spared us most of the time telling us about all of our past lives, and who can tell us the truth about a lot of things. We're very blessed in that way. You know, there are a lot of very, very well-meaning people. This is what happened with me and the rabbi. that rabbi meant well. He studied his whole life to be able to stand up and give that talk on Yom Kippur. But he was telling me what he had read in books and then interpreted. He was not telling me, I've had an experience of the divine, and I know the truth. I know what it is to be one with God. He wasn't. He wouldn't even have claimed that. And I suddenly realized that and didn't want to be there. I just didn't believe the words that he was saying. I still don't believe the words he was saying. So I went to medical school. I wound up applying to medical schools, Harvard, Yale, Duke, Stanford. Why did I do that? Because he said I had to go to an Ivy League school. And I went all through Stanford Medical School. It was wonderful. I loved medicine. I loved being in school. 3 weeks before graduation, the dean of student affairs calls me in. And he says to me, Shanti, we have a problem here. And he and I had become good friends because I was so much older than everybody else. I was 32 when I started, so now I was 36. He said, we can't find your undergraduate degree. So I said, I don't have one. He says to me, that is impossible. Just like that, incredulous. Stanford would never accept anybody without an undergraduate degree. Now, I don't know how many of you have gone to college. I'm not going to ask. How many of you have graduate degrees? You can't go to graduate school without an undergraduate degree. It is impossible. It is. He was right. But I said to him, look, John, first of all, you're in good company because I was accepted at these other schools too. Second of all, you do have a problem because I'm graduating in 3 weeks. True story. They gave me an honorary bachelor's degree of medical sciences because they couldn't give me an MD. Now, that's impossible. You understand? That is like the parting of the Red Seas. It is. People have asked me, what did I write on the application? I don't remember. I have no idea. Yogananda just closed my eyes to it. And I went through medical school, and I never went to college. I mean, I took a few college courses, but I never got a degree. Remember I told you I went to a 3-year nursing program. You get a certificate. I have had an enormous amount to do with death and dying in my life, both personally in my family and professionally. For some reason, I'm around a lot when a lot of people are dying. And it's these experiences and some of what we will talk about today that make me think that this is what Master had in mind when he said to me, you'll be practicing in unusual ways and you'll need credibility. Because, you know, when you have to look at a doctor and say, you will not stop this resuscitation, or many of the other things that subsequently happened, not through my power, but because this is how Master was going to work through me. Just like these masters have a way of working through everybody in this room. And I know that. I just get to be up here speaking right now, but we all come in. We all have a purpose. We all have our karma. Of course, we need to talk about karma and reincarnation today because it's a misnomer to say the class is about death and dying. It is. But how could you talk about death and dying without talking about how to live? It's really all about how we live. Because I'm assuming since we added this piece, death and dying, what did we say? As a spiritual journey, right? So everybody who's here is interested in it from a spiritual perspective. Okay. Now, I'd like to stop for just a moment, and I'd like to ask, and we're small enough to do this, I'd like to hear from anybody who wants to tell me so that we can make sure we go there. What drew you here today? What would you like to hear? What are you looking for? What experiences have you had around death or dying that brought you here? Yes. I see. Is he on dialysis or? Not yet. Yes. I see. Okay. So he's quite ill. Yeah. And are you his primary caregiver? Yeah. Okay. Have you been around anybody who's died before?
No.
And I don't know you at all. Okay, good. I was going to ask you. And it's not going to be new to you, but it's still, it's quite different, isn't it? Very good. Wow. Yeah, that's how it happens. They come to us, right? Wow. You mean you just got here from? Wow. I see. Didn't I see you at the open house or no? I did see you. Yeah, that's what I thought. So that was the day you arrived in California? In Scotts Valley, yeah. Okay. Yeah. See, we think we know. We have no idea. In a way, we just have to live our lives such that we're open to that, to whatever. I mean, really, and trust the puppeteer, if you will. I mean, it's really quite amazing. Yeah. So, good. I'm glad you're here. We'll talk a little bit later about, really, I mean, you sound like you know a lot anyway, but we'll be able to share here. Again, speaking a lot from these teachings, that's why I wanted to speak about Yogananda being an avatar, but about what it means and how to help people leave and, you know, what it is exactly that we can do for them and for ourselves as well. And I will say something else. When my mother died, and I had already been through nursing for 14 years and a lot of time in medicine, and I already told you it's a calling. I'm around a lot of people who die. Somebody wrote me a note. I wish I'd brought it today, but I didn't think to. And I haven't read it now for years, but I've kept it. But in there, she said something like, no matter what the situation or how prepared we are, it's always stunning. She used the word stunning. And you know, I was used to using the word stunning like beautiful, stunning. But it really got my attention. It was a very beautiful letter. And I think there's something about that because the truth is we're in these bodies. We're operating on this physical plane. And all of the sudden to realize that that being who you've shared so much with, who you've grown with in whatever ways you've grown, who you've been interdependent with, I mean, whatever the situation is suddenly gone. It is just stunning, even no matter how prepared you are for it. So I'm glad you're here. I think just even speaking about it a little bit and your experience of it will help you as you move closer. Anybody else? Yeah, words really are inadequate. And particularly if somebody's not of this, I want to say mind, but it's really beyond mind, our words in fact can do exactly the opposite and make it much harder for them. But our energy won't do that. And, you know, so it's wonderful that you're here. But one of the things that I learned very early on in medical school when my classmates would all come to me because, you know, they were kids. They were 21 years old when they were in medical school, and most of them had never seen anybody die. And it's, well, how many people in this room have been with somebody when they've passed? Yeah, so a lot of you. So, you know, it can be challenging. I mean, the physical appearance and way of it, it very often is almost physically ugly. I mean, it's the body contorts and it goes through its thing again. I don't know what anybody else's experience is. Every once in a while, I've been around somebody who's just taken their last breath and left. But often, that's not the way. So it's very powerful to be there. When I had a sister who was 3 years older than I am. She died when she was 42 years old. And I went and spent the last, like, 10 days with her in the hospital where she was. And we were very, very connected. We had had a really challenging relationship in life. I mean, very challenging. But But that doesn't matter. In that challenge, we were very deeply connected. I mean, who's to say it's supposed to be beautiful to be connected? It's energy with magnetism. And this magnetism was difficult, but we were really drawn. She had called me and asked me to come and help her die. She said, "I'm sick." I said, "How sick?" She said, "I'm dying. Please come and help me die." So I did. I mean, 2 weeks later, she was gone. But when I was there, I had one of the most profound experiences I've ever had with anybody dying with her. As she was leaving, which took days and days, I felt like I was traveling with her somewhere. I've never had the experience before or since. Since that time. And she would come out of that and she would say to me, I'd say to her, "Gwen, wasn't that beautiful?" She would say, "It's so beautiful. You come with me, Shanti." And I would say, "You know, sweetie, it's not my time. I'm not supposed to go." But I said, "Look where you're going." She'd say, "This." None of this is in words, by the way. This is just communicating. She'd say, and I've never done this before since with anybody. I don't do these things. I don't have visions. Ever. So she said to me, "I know, but I'd rather you come." And we went on like that for a while. And then one day, I mean, just telling you how intense it was, my mother came into the room and she said, "I've decided nobody can come into the room with you." This is in response to what you're talking about, DJ. "Nobody's allowed in to see Gwen anymore but you." I mean, here's a 42-year-old dying. Her parents are out there, her siblings. I said, "Mom, why?" She said, "She just gets agitated with everybody else. She calms down when you're there." So I said, "How about if I come out and talk to everybody and talk to them a little bit about how to be with people when they're leaving, rather than making a rule that they can't be there?" It's a pretty poignant moment in life as somebody's passing. So I said to them, "When you go in to see her, don't touch her. Don't speak to her. If you want to tell her you love her, think it. Because she's in such a highly sensitized state," I told them. "She will hear you. If you want to hug her," I said to them long before the days this word was popular, but I literally said it, "give her a hug like a virtual hug. Just hug her in your mind. She will feel your love." And I'm saying it to you specifically because I came to learn even much more how true that was. When people are moving more and more towards being in a state away from the material plane, withdrawing into more of a pure energetic state again. Now, we don't know what they're going to do with that energy. It's not like everybody who dies goes to the same heaven and that's it. That's not at all what happens. A lot depends on, well, it depends on so many things, which we'll talk about, but who you've been, where you've been directing your energy, where you're directing your energy at that very last moment of life. Literally, Swamiji says, no matter what life you've lived, if at the moment that your soul's exiting this body, you think about God, right then, it will change everything that happens to your soul after that. Isn't that just so beautiful and relieving? And it's very relieving when we're helping people die who are not consciously on a spiritual path. You see, everybody's on a spiritual path. That's the other misnomer about the title of this. Death and dying is a spiritual journey. Everything in our life is a spiritual journey. Everything, every single moment, whether we're aware of it or not, is another thing. But I'm saying it to you because our inclination is to tell people how they should die. It'll even invite them sometimes to go a certain way, to think a certain thought, to hear our talks about don't worry, nothing's happening, just your soul leaving, nothing's going to change. I mean, we could say whatever we want to say. And they're just not ready to hear it. And what they have to do in response to that is shut down even more. But if you sit by them and you open your heart and you silently pray for them and you pray that God will come to them, you pray for them, not just for them, but you pray as if you are them, you can do an enormous amount of good. And most likely, how many people in this room have ever been able to talk somebody out of their religious or spiritual beliefs and into another? Doesn't work. It's like trying to change a political party that somebody's devoted to. There are two things we cannot talk people into or out of. It's just the way life is. Yeah, you're right. So, do you pronounce your name Nadir? Nader. Nader. Okay. What Nader's saying, I'm repeating it so that it makes it on here, is really very much in a way like what DJ's question is, which is, how do we help people who have no belief in anything? And you mentioned, and I agree with you, when people are at ease, when they believe that it is a freeing of the soul, a way of moving forward, when it's not even quite a beginning, but just an ongoing path to expanded soul consciousness, they have an easier time leaving. But what about all the people who don't believe in anything? And whether they're from mixed marriages or not, we see it a lot. I mean, let's face it, we're in the minority. Everybody who's in this room is in the minority. We're all looking for something spiritually or we wouldn't be here. We've all gotten to the place where we're conscious of that, which is huge. But, you know, and this is when Yogananda said, and this is very important for us to know, when one of the monks that lived with him said to him, "Oh, Master, I just don't think I have very good karma." And Yogananda said with a lot of power and force, "Don't ever say that. You have to have very, very, very good karma to even want to know God." So I feel, and I mean, I feel we are among those people. I feel it every Sunday when I look out at the church, 100 and some people standing out there. I think, okay, these are one of the, as Krishna says in the Gita, out of 1,000, one will look for me. Out of 1,000 who look, one will find me in this life. But then I can say to everybody, as I would say to you, we are those 1 in 1,000. It's who we are. We wouldn't be here otherwise. We're searching. Let me back up for a minute and talk a little bit about karma. Because I think to be able to understand the real answer to this issue that you're raising, we have to understand and accept the notion of karma. Because without it, life doesn't make any sense. Death doesn't make any sense. The people we're involved with don't make any sense. What we should want for ourselves, what we should want for them, doesn't make any sense. So I'll just speak. I assume a lot of you have heard a lot of this before, but let me put it in the context of these teachings and of this topic, this whole notion. I've been speaking freely as if everybody in this room believes in reincarnation, and there's some of you that I don't know, so I don't really know where you are with that or if you think it might make sense, but you're not sure. So I just want to speak a little bit about it. And I'm just, again, going to speak about it as Yogananda and Kriyananda presented it to us. Because although I've had some of these experiences that I've shared with you, and again, I know you could, and maybe you will before we're done here today, share some of your own experiences that say to me, I'm certain that there's about reincarnation. I feel that without a doubt. So many things have happened in my life where I've been drawn to people, where I've been in situations that say to me, I've known, even before I knew about Yogananda, it never made sense to me. We live one life and then we're done. And by the way, that's what traditional Judaism teaches. And I mean, you watch a Jewish person die, by and large, they are not happy about it. Because they have no idea. They're just like dead. Can you imagine thinking that there's nothing that would happen after that? I mean, it just feels so dark and forlorn to me. But that is, now again, that's not the Kabbalists, that's not the mystical Jews. But, you know, when I was growing up, nobody was talking about the Kabbalists and in the way they are now. But there are many people who feel that way, many. I think in most traditional religions, it's not spoken about very much, even though in his interpretation of the Bible, which you could buy right out here, Swami Kriyananda, and it's a brilliant piece of work. I mean, it's inspired. It's the completely, as is everything he wrote, but shows many, many examples. He takes things that Jesus said, and he shows how what Jesus was talking about was reincarnation. But I don't think that's the way most Christians believe it. Catholicism talks about it a little more, but I don't think most Christians think about it at all, even though Jesus said it. Again, this is the difference between having an avatar and having somebody who's just interpreted these works on their own, just their opinion. Why would we say our opinion didn't matter just as much? Particularly our opinion, again, those of us here. But, you know, everything in this world is energy. Everything. Everything is energy. If some of you have heard me say this before, just bear with me. It's impossible to talk about karma and reincarnation without talking about it. And it's energy that, if we could see it or feel it or know it, is always reduced to the same common denominator. Some years ago, not that many, 10, we thought that smallest unit of energy was a neutrino. Now, the physicists are showing us, no, neutrinos are large compared to, I don't know anything about this other than what I'm going to say to you, but leptons, quarks, I mean, these tiny little units of measure. But here's what's important about it. You see, the quantum physicists are discovering right now what these great masters have been telling us for thousands of years. And what is interesting is they're putting science behind it, and they'll do that to a certain degree that'll get a lot of people's attention. When push comes to shove, and I don't know how many of you heard my talk at Spiritual Renewal Week last year, but I had to say this, even though Purushottama, who's writing a book about the physics of God, so he's somebody on this path who's a physicist, is trying to show how the quantum physicists are defining that which is the divine right now, what we call superconsciousness. What we talk about being inspired. It means tuning into our highest, most expansive self, which is, after all, what God is, in whatever name we give it. I said to Puru, who was sitting in the first row when I was giving my talk, after he gave his, with all due respect, Puru, no matter how close the scientists come to defining this, they are still working at it from their mind. That chasm between science and spirit might be nothing more than the width of a lepton, but it's there. You cannot get to this stuff with the mind. Is the mind interesting? Do we love reading about it? Yes. But you cannot know these truths. You can't. You have to meditate. It's the only way. I mean, unless Divine Mother herself comes and offers you a spiritual experience, which happens. You know, people know things. That's some of those weird things that were happening to me. Fortunately, I listened and didn't just write it off, but I had no part in that. That was just grace, pure grace. But you see, otherwise, to have an experience of what we're talking about right now and about to talk about with karma and reincarnation, you have to enter into a practice that is beyond anything we know on this earth. If that's just the way it is. To be willing to accept death, you would almost have to have been somebody who meditated or who prayed so deeply, call it what you want, that you wound up having an experience, a true experience of God. And then you came out of that experience and you knew it without a doubt. That's what happened. Asha Osip often tells this story. I remember right now where I'm going, but in case I forget, somebody help me remember. I'm talking about energy. But I just want to interject this story about this Catholic priest who loved being a priest. I'm going to shorten it a little. Devoted to the Catholic Church. He was more than a priest, but I don't know enough to say what he was. And he just poured himself into his life, and he just got exhausted. I think nobody's ever told this story. I didn't read the book. And I think the book is called I Was a Priest or I Was a Monk. We never knew if he had tuberculosis or just got exhausted. But he wound up being sent off to Switzerland to rest. And he was resting every day, all day. He had no responsibility anymore. And he loved God, and he felt very connected to God. This is a true story, by the way. So he prayed and prayed and prayed, and Christ came to him. Christ appeared to him in visions day after day then. And suddenly he realized that everything he had been teaching in the Catholic Church was not true. He knew it was not true, and he had to go back and leave his position. There was a priest who had a huge heart, devoted, loved it, but had never had an experience of God. And when he did, he knew he couldn't go back and keep saying the same things to people. Like what? You're only going to go to heaven if you're Catholic? You can go on and on. A lot of the dogmatism, even the dogma of the Catholic Church, just like all of the religions have dogma. And the dogma is one thing, gets to be dogmatism, it's worse, but whatever it was. So you know what I'm trying to say? You can't learn this stuff from your mind, and you can't begin to accept the notion of death unless you believe that there's something bigger than what we know. Otherwise, it would just be horrible. You're just leaving everything you know. That's it. Out of the body, that's it. Done. But it's not that way. So, everything is energy. The only reason that anything looks separate, now this is true, this is not just me saying this. In the end, it's quantum physics, though I can't speak that language to you. It's because everything is vibrating at a different frequency. And when things vibrate, same exact, they're not molecules, they're units. Is ice a different substance than water running down a stream or than steam? It's two molecules of hydrogen and one of oxygen. But what's happening? You put a little heat under it, you change the vibratory frequency, you have steam. You slow it down a little, energetically, you have ice. Now we even know you can look at water in its crystalline form. You can take pictures of it. We know all this now. We didn't know it. Now we know everything is energy. Now here's where it's a leap of faith. It's not just the things. It's not just that Doug and I are really one. It's not that if we knew this, like Socrates said, to know something is to be it. If we knew it in that way, we could just walk right through each other. It wouldn't be a problem. There would be nothing separate. This is how some of these psychic surgeons work. I've seen it. I've literally seen somebody put their hand in somebody's belly right in front of me. Pretty mind-boggling. But the only reason we can't do that is because we're vibrating at a particular gross frequency. And the other thing, the instant that the soul attaches itself to a body, the very instant that the sperm and ovum unite and the soul says, that's where I want to reincarnate, and it's in there, there's an ego. Because, Yogananda says, the ego is the soul identified with the body. Once there's an ego, once you've identified with the body, duality. You forget where you came from. And suddenly, all of your interest is in this body. How's this body going to be? How much does it weigh? What kind of hair do I have? Is it healthy? Is it not? Before long, you're looking out into the world. You're looking to see what you can get that's going to make you happy, make you feel fulfilled. It might be a different house. It might be a partner. It might be a pair of shoes. It might be your health. It might be your children's health. It goes on and on. We actually believe that if we get those things, we'll be happy. We're confused. We got turned around 180 degrees, exactly away from the very thing that is joy, that is happiness, that place that we have come from. Now, unfortunately, we can't make it back there in one lifetime. We just can't. Very much like, things change in life. We don't go through all of life in one suit of clothing. We start life, we're little, we're babies, we're toddlers, we're this, then we're old. Things change. That's what can happen in one life. But there's change that goes on. You're not behaving the same way, acting the same way when you're little as you are when you're big. That's what a soul is. It's a physically manifested aspect of all the energy that ever was or will be that we call super consciousness, and it's manifested in all these ways. I often think when I look at that Mary back there, because this is, I've often thought there was consciousness, and it was made up of an infinite number of sparkly little things. And one day it had a thought, I'm going to put these sparkles out. Like that. Infinite number of sparkling things become rocks, trees, insects, gems, bugs, everything. Everything. Chairs. But here's where it's tricky. This is what I started saying. It's our thoughts too. A thought is energy. A thought is actually nothing more than energy that's being put into action. Words are crystallized thoughts. That's what they are. So they have the exact same impact on everybody and everything as any action does. This is that story from the autobiography of a yogi when Master Yogananda was being really upset by mosquitoes. He was trying to meditate with his guru. And he had the idea that he was going to kill the mosquito, and he raised his hand. But then he had a flash. Oh, I can't harm that mosquito. That's as much a part of the divine as I am. Put his hands back down. And Sri Yukteswar says to him, why don't you just finish the act? And Yogananda says, but I didn't. You know, like, don't I get any credit for not? Sri Yukteswar said, you thought it. And just think about this, that every time you have a thought about yourself that's limiting, about anybody else that's limiting, that's negative, we are bundles of energy. And what happens as that energy manifests, as this body that we know, sperm and ovum come together, soul enters the body, the very first thing that's formed is the medulla oblongata, where the ego resides. After that, the whole, they're called neuronal tubes, doesn't matter what they're really called anatomically, our whole nervous system, then the heart, then the lungs, the kidneys, on and on. But right in the very core of our being resides still that energy. And we call that our astral spine. So we are these causal beings, pure energy. Thought comes. We decide we need to be reincarnated for reasons that I'm going to come back to. We enter this body. Not happenstance, by the way. We are drawn because we're pure energy. Everything's energy. We all know energy has a positive and a negative pole. It's magnetic. It's always magnetic under every single circumstance. So the sperm and ovum that you're drawn to is a very particular reason for you. And the reason is whatever it is that your soul needs to keep finding its way back to a pure state with the divine, you're going to find right there. You may not happen to think that if you're born into a family of abusive parents or extreme poverty or somebody who beats you. You grow up thinking, why is this happening to me? Why is this happening to me? Most of us don't grow up thinking, why is this happening to me? Really? Why? What am I doing here? What can I learn here? How can I move so that my soul will grow and expand and move back towards that which it is longing for? And we just get confused. We actually think a pair of red shoes is going to bring us what our soul wants. No way. It doesn't happen that way. Do we think it really matters if we're 10 pounds heavier or thinner? Do you think so? Really? What is that about? We could just go on and on. You see, there's an infinite number of ways that we get confused. And the confusion that keeps us in that place of longing and of needing, of judging people, of judging ourselves, all of this being energy, here we are, energy, all of those things, actions, thoughts, reactions, in a very subtle way, put an imprint in our astral spine. And it lives there. And in certain places in that astral spine, that energy forms a vortex. Those little vortices of energy we call chakras. And they're real. You can't happen to see them. I mean, we can't see them. Some people see them. Some people can see right through and see your chakras. Certainly Yogananda could see them. And other great saints who are not confused by energy vibrating at different levels. But every single moment of every life is affecting what's happening in our astral spine. It is virtually impossible that it doesn't. Everything is energy that can neither be created nor destroyed, but can always be transformed. And everything comes under that physical law of this universe. Everything. So we can't get away with anything. Yogananda couldn't think about hitting the mosquito, not hitting it. Sri Yukteswar said, done. Now, he was teaching him a lesson. It's better that the mosquito didn't die. So we have to start living our lives with that intention, with that urgency, with that commitment that every moment of every life is going to have to do with what happens when we die. Because it will. You know, in my practice, I very often write people prescriptions for very unusual things. I don't practice regular medicine anymore. My practice is called transformational medicine. And when people come to see me, so it happened yesterday. I'll just give you an example. A couple came to my MedOne class, not this past Thursday, but the past Thursday, which was the first night. And I was just teaching Med 1, but for a lot of reasons, they were drawn to me. They came up to me afterwards. They told me she has chronic pain, young woman. And they started telling me a lot of their story. I said, I can't do this here. I said, I can't. They said, can we see you in your practice? I said, absolutely. So they made an appointment, and they came in. Now, she's a woman who was raised in a home where people meditate. And it had an impact on her. She would call herself a very spiritual woman. And she is, whatever that means to all of us. I mean, Google the word spirituality, you get millions, literally millions now, of responses. But it means she believes in something bigger than herself. Nothing I'm saying today would surprise her. So I listened to her story. I asked them to send me all of the blood work and the imaging studies that have been done, all of which I want to see because I'm not sure that her doctors, I think doctors tend to write off particularly women with chronic pain. And so I didn't know that they've really done a thorough study, you know, and we would treat her differently if she had fibromyalgia or if she had chronic fatigue syndrome or, you know, I'm sure many of them are thinking, quote unquote, it's all in her head. I just know how the medical system works. I said, send me everything. But then that took an hour of our visit. I started talking to her about meditating or doing what she could do to help herself. And I could see right away what was going on for her. I started talking to her about keeping company with uplifted people, about watching what colors she wore all the time, about stopping in for a Sunday service or a kirtan chanting or coming to a class, even if she had to get up and move around because she can't stay still. Or I gave her links. I said, watch a 20-minute talk once a day, every day. And I could see. And so I said to her, I'm going to tell you what's going on in your mind right now. But I said, don't think I'm too smart. I see this a lot. You're thinking to yourself, you'll do all of that once you're better. She goes like that. I said to her, I'm trying to tell you what to do to get better. I'm not telling you that I can get rid of your pain. I don't know that. I'm not a magician. I don't know what's going to happen with your pain. But I'm telling you that if you start doing this, you will have a completely different relationship to your pain. You will have a completely different, you will become a different container in which to hold your pain. Everything in your life would change. Her husband was sitting there saying like this. She was looking down. And I said to her, I can see I'm not going to talk you into this right now. Fair enough. But I'm going to write it all out for you. And I'm going to write you 4 prescriptions. They're on a prescription pad, you know, that you go home and you do these things. Because of what I'm saying to all of you right now, I want to take care of her medically if there's anything I can do. If she needs medicines, I'll prescribe them. Remember, I told you I'm not opposed to that. But every single thought that we have, everything we do with our mind is impacting our astral spine. It's keeping chakras shut down like this, tight, tense, pain, dark, like that. Or it's doing this, and it's allowing energy to flow. And all of this has everything to do with what happens when we get to the moment of leaving our body. And honestly, if we've meditated enough such that we even have an idea that we're just on this road, that as Swami says over and over, nothing happens when we die. Nothing. That piece of the soul that is us, it's an individualized piece. It's kind of a personalized piece. There's a word for this called jiva in Sanskrit. And those characteristics that are us keep being there in whatever plane the soul goes to. Whenever we're reincarnated, we would be recognizable in a lot of ways. But the soul's on a journey. And we have to be consciously and with some energy making that journey, or very quickly, energetic gravity, really gravity, gets a hold of us, because it's shockingly easy to live with delusion. It's just shockingly easy. There's an endless number of ways to get drawn in. Now, what I wanted to say specifically about this, and when we come back, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, I'll take more questions and answers and stories if you want, and then I'll move on, is that your karma, because those imprints on your jiva, which becomes your astral spine in this life, they're yours. They're as unique as a snowflake, as a fingerprint. No two souls are ever alike. We're manifested from the same energy, but we are completely different. I can't live your karma for you. I can't make any changes. Believe me, I suffered with this with my husband. This is a different husband. That husband who helped me go to medical school died some years ago. This husband, we're together 29 years now. And, I love this man so deeply, and I've never had a doubt that he's mine. We belong together. It's been very clear to me, and I've been told it over and over. But until 2 years ago, and this is the truth, and I told this even 4 years ago, so it was not easy. This has not been like, wow, the love of your life, everything's perfect. Boy, everything goes, no way. And certainly there's me in there, and, I'm a handful. I mean, I really am. I have a big personality, and I mean, you can feel me even now. Imagine trying to live with this all the time. But by his own admission, Barry was difficult. He was moody. He was negative. He was depressed. He had a very, very difficult beginning to this life. So did I, by the way. Somehow I just didn't stay there. He got stuck there. So, like the nice little Jewish mom, girl, woman, I took it upon myself for 27 years to make him happy. Why does it say 27 years? Because it came to me about 7 years ago. It came to me. You can't make him be happy, Shanti. You cannot solve his problems. You can be the biggest and the best you can be. You behave in such a way so that when each day comes to an end, you feel good about how you've been. He has to make the choice to be happy. And then I said to him, after that realization came, one of the things I've realized, Barry, is that I've been very unfair to you. Because as I look at you, when I come home from work and you are in what I would call a bad mood, and you know, it's energy. I could feel it right away. It's like walking into a wall. And I got to the point where I would get a stomachache before I walked into the house. I said, but you know, I don't walk in. You don't say to me, I'm so miserable. I say to you, how are you? You say, fine. Why? I say, are you sure nothing's wrong? Why are you even asking me that? So I said, what I realize is that you're okay with how you are. Why am I trying to change you? So what I'm going to do from now on is, parenthetically, we have two homes. We've had two homes for 30 years. It's been brilliant, and it works. And it wasn't about him. I just always knew I couldn't live with anybody. I need some room and time alone. So I know that wouldn't work for most couples, but for me, perfect. So I said to him, and I have a home in the community, an Onda community, and we have this other beautiful house in Menlo Park. And I said to him, when I walk in and I feel that, no more discussion. I said, I promise you this. I said, imagine you don't have to listen to me, the carping spirit over here. I'm not going to talk to you about it anymore. I'm going to come over. I'm going to kiss you. I'm going to say, sweetheart, I love you, and I'm leaving. When you're ready to be with me in a way you know that I would like, call me. I'll come right back. I love you. I'm not leaving. I'm going to my house. Well, he never liked that, of course. He always wanted me to be with him. He did. That's the truth, always. And he started changing. Not because I was harping on him for all those years. Didn't mean anything. It's when I actually backed up and could love him exactly as he was that he could begin to change. We cannot change other people's karma. We can't live their karma. It's virtually impossible, you see, because it's energy. It's magnetic. We're either drawing something to us or repelling it, and nobody can change that. Only we can change it. Only we can go inside and work on it. So I can tell you the one or two arguments that Barry and I have had for all of our time together, and most couples here will admit you're arguing about the same thing 20 years later and nothing's changed. And that's really pretty much the truth. That's the way it goes. Because somebody has to stop and really want to change. And as soon as you want to change, then you can do it. So the answer really is that all you can do when you're with somebody who's dying, who is unaware and has chosen to stay unaware, is go into your spine and be radiating love and goodwill and acceptance and joy. Become one of those divine manifestations, or manifestations of divine energy, I should say. You become it. If there's anything in them that's ready to be, have their astral spine be affected by it, they will. And if they're not, they won't. And there is nothing else we can do. But as soon as we quit taking it on, we're freer. I just want to share one other story. I'm sorry, I know everybody must need a break, but it's so relevant to this point. When I was a nurse and my first husband was a doctor, I was taking some classes. This is before I knew I was going to medical school and I didn't need the degree. I was at UC San Diego thinking I was going to get a PhD in psychology. That's what I was going to do. And my husband and I worked weekends at a hospital in Southern California called on Mission Bay. Very popular place in San Diego, very busy. We would work like crazy there. I worked for 8 hours. He worked for 12. So I was the nurse in the emergency room. He was the doctor. I would be assisting him. And then for 4 hours, because I was in college now, I would go to the doctor's on-call room and study and wait for him to be done. One day a woman walks in, and she had a vaginal infection. So Barry examined her. By the way, both of my husband's names are Barry, so don't get confused. This was Barry number one. He examined her, and she had this condition, and I was there helping him, called Gardnerella, which in those days we thought of as a sexually transmitted disease. It could be easily treated, wasn't life-threatening, wasn't like HIV or herpes or a lot of the things we know about now. But she had it. So this ER was really busy. That's why I was saying to you, big place right on the bay in San Diego. So he just like, okay, here. I mean, he was a really good man and a great doctor, but moving. Gives her a prescription and he's off. 2 hours later, I'm sitting at the station, the nurse's station, and I get a feeling about this woman that she's in trouble. Now, and here I'm telling you, but really these things do not happen all that much, but it happened. I couldn't shake an idea of her. So I was drawn to go out into the parking lot, and she's out there in her car sobbing. This is 2 hours later. And I said to her, honey, what's going on? She said, I'm so embarrassed and I'm so ashamed and blah, blah. And I'm in the car and I'm holding her and this is nothing to be ashamed of. And, you know, there but for the grace of God goes most of us. And anyway, she felt better and she left. That was very sweet. 2 hours later, I'm done with my shift. I go to the doctor's room and suddenly I feel. Now, and I'm saying it to you seriously. Every woman in this room will be able to relate to this, but the men can hear it. No. I suddenly feel myself develop a vaginal discharge. I could feel it coming out of me. That is ridiculous. So I said to Barry, I wasn't thinking anything. Honey, when we're all done, you're going to have to examine me. Something's going on. He examines me, and what do you think I have? Gardnerella. I took that lady's gardnerella from her. And I said to myself right then, you will never do this again. This was a little vaginal infection that you could treat. Could be cancer. Could be heart disease. Could be anything. We don't belong in each other's energy that way. It is very important to not try and move in terms of somebody else's energy and to be conscious of it. Did that make me less empathic, less compassionate? Of course not. In fact, probably more in ways that we can talk about later. But it was so crucial to learn that lesson. Each person, not only do they have to go through their own life in their own way with their own karma, but it's perfect that they do. It's just perfect. Okay, I'm going to stop. Before we leave this topic, does anybody here want to make any comments? Or?
Wow.
Yeah, what can you do? So I think the realization is very, very important that you can love somebody, you can feel for them, you can be with them. Number one, nothing that's going on is wrong. That's a hard one, right? Because there you are holding a mother whose child was just killed or father whose child was just killed or somebody who's just received a diagnosis of some bad cancer or... I mean, I've been through a lot in my life personally, and I'm sure everyone in this room has. It's not always easy. It's not just like, oh, gee, honey, I'm sorry your car was broken into and you lost your computer, which could be, I mean, it would freak me out if that happened to me. But I mean, that's not really quite anything. But even with no matter what it is, you know, at a soul level, there's almost no difference, if you see what I mean. Whatever's happening is so perfect. It's so wonderful. For the soul, not from the ego. But we're talking about trying to solve soul problems from an ego reality. You can't do it, nor can it happen vice versa. So I think the first thing is to let go of the idea that something bad is happening. And when you do that, you release your attachment to it. And energy flows in a very different way. You know, really part of, and we can start here when we come back, part of what we're talking about is non-attachment. It's a big part of what we're talking about. And learning that, not just trying to convince ourselves, but putting ourselves in a position where we begin to learn it and know it to be true, without a doubt. Because we can't fool this energy. You can't fool energy. You can say, I'm not upset, I'm not upset, I'm not upset. And if you're tense and tight and upset, you may as well just say I'm miserable because it's the truth. You can't fool what's real is real. Self-honesty is the most important thing on the spiritual path. Literally, the most important thing in terms of what we can do so that we're not trying to live somebody else's karma, so we're not trying to solve their problems so that we know where we are in the world and what is our next step forward, not anybody else's. What is our next step, which is the other answer to the question? And I go through this all the time with people. If we're trying to have somebody else take our next step, it doesn't work. It's going to injure them. If we look at them with no attachment, none, and say to ourselves, really, where is this person? And what would it mean for them to move forward? What is their next step? Then we can just give that generously, lovingly, compassionately, with all of our energy, and we're not attached to the outcome. As soon as we need somebody to be something, all bets are off. You're going to own it. I was miserable all those years. Miserable. I used to tell everybody how miserable things were. Instead of being able to say, you know, this just was not one of those fairy tale marriages. I knew it. I knew that karmically it was right for me, but I was miserable. At 7 years ago, when I started letting go of needing to fix Barry, boy, I got so much better. And then the reason we're together happened. For me, it was learning to practice unconditional love. And one other lesson about not necessarily pursuing. This is very personal. It doesn't matter to any of you, but I'm just finishing a thought. I had two lessons to learn here. Unconditional love and realizing that lust wasn't going to get me anywhere in the world. Lust was not going to take my soul where it wanted to go. This relationship was born in that. And it was not the first time I'd made that mistake, so Divine Mother sort of said to me, okay, Shanti, before you leave this time, you're going to learn this lesson. And I can tell you, I always felt grateful, even when it was hard, because I kept getting in my meditation, stay, he is yours. As long as you're both in this body, he is yours. And now, we're so close. There is such a deep love, and we're such great friends. And I feel like, that's a big bit of karma that I work through. There's something else about that I'm going to tell you, but I'll start there when we come back. Let's take a 10-minute break or so. Okay. So, everybody came up, almost everybody in the room, and either asked me a question or made a comment, even though I was asking for it during the class. You know, it's very useful when you ask questions or tell a story, because really everybody gets to hear it, and then I get to expound on it, and it's wonderful. So, who was asking me a question or making a statement wants to talk out loud? You know what? There's many things about what you're saying, Elaine. One is that, and I've said this a couple times, but I want to say it in a unique way right now. We don't really know what's happening. We can't know. I mean, unless we literally have, even psychic ability isn't what we're talking about here. But to really know, typically we would say the soul stays in a body as long as it can be learning spiritual lessons, as long as it's something has something to learn there, because each lifetime is unique in some way, and that when it's quit having any ability to learn any spiritual lessons, it leaves. Now, I was speaking to Carolyn, she left, but I was saying once again, if we can practice our own non-attachment, and I'm not saying it like it's easy. It's one of the basic tenets in the Bhagavad Gita. It's the essence of life, is to be here, to live the best we can do, to perform our duty, our spiritual duty, without any attachment to outcome. You know, well, we would be saints if we could do that. But that doesn't mean we don't try and do that, that that's our goal. So I don't know, and I'm asking you, I guess, why. How does it have an impact on you that your mom's hanging around, and why? Like, what if you just let her be here as long as she wants to be here? I could say to you, and I want you to answer that in a second, you could say to her, Mom, it's okay for you to leave whenever you think it's time. Maybe she really doesn't know that. And it's amazing how many people die after that. Maybe she's just afraid and you can't help her, like with my sister. I couldn't say to her, don't be afraid. She was like, okay, but you come with me. She was having none of this, having to take off on her own. And, you know, she was terrified. But all I could do was be there and become the teachings. And I mean that really, like the way Yogananda talked about the eight manifestations of divine energy, when they're pure, that's the thing, and that's hard. Pure love, pure joy, pure power, pure sound, pure light, peace, calmness. I'm missing one, and I don't know what it is, but it doesn't matter. You know, if we could be absolutely, utterly calm, which is one of the earlier ways that we can get in touch with this, peace and calmness, or pure, though. I mean, it's genuine. It's real. That you say to yourself, what if she lives another 2 years? I mean, why? What's tugging on you about it is really the question. And I'm not demeaning whatever your answer is going to be, but I'm saying if you could look at that, and say, now you might say to me, she's eating up all of our finances, or I don't know, but can you answer it? I don't want you to think, I don't know that. When my first husband died, he was an extraordinarily powerful man. I mean, literally, he was known around the world. He was big. I mean, he was 6'4", and he was big, and he was just pure power. Fortunately, I had enough of a dose of my own, but he was a big man. That man did not want to leave his body, and his death was really the hardest death I've ever was. I mean, I was there with him the whole time when he was dying, but after he died and the body was taken away and this and that, I went right over to Asha Praver's house, and you know, she's the spiritual director of our community, and I just broke down. I just cried for 2 hours. It was so I'm saying to you, I could get it. He didn't want to leave, and that made it so hard. He would quit breathing for 5 minutes, then breathe again. That man was used to being in charge. So I'm speaking to you about the truth. I'm not saying to you, be ashamed, but I'm hoping that you'll hear something that might just have you say, it's okay. If she's having a hard time, you know, the truth is, it's totally okay. She'll work it out. She'll be back. She'll get to work on those qualities. She's enjoyed being in charge and in control, and that's had its own inherent suffering this whole life. If you could say to yourself, she's just being who she's been. She's just not choosing to change at the time when it's time for her to go. And just say to yourself, and I mean this, I'm saying this to you with great empathy, not clinically, as they would say. But I'm saying, what if you started saying to yourself, I'm just going to let her be who she is. It's totally fine. And I don't need to suffer about who she is. That was the whole point of my story with my Barry number two, you know, is to, we can't change these people. And they, you can trust that in ways you can't know, what's ever happening for her, I'm telling you, these are not just words. It's perfect. It's perfect. Now, that may be hard for you, and maybe I can't give it to you in a way, but I know for sure that it's true. There cannot be mistakes about things that happen in life. And it looks that way. We don't want to accept things. We don't want to believe it. But there cannot be a mistake. And if you could really sit with that and get to believe that inside, then you would say, it's fine who she is. I was just telling Carolyn before she left, my mother died in my arms. And I came back and I said to a friend, how could it be that somebody lives a whole life and doesn't learn anything spiritually? I don't think my mother grew one iota in this life. And I meant it. I said, how could that be? And this woman looked at me. My mother died a number of years ago, but she said to me, no, the blessing in this life for her, and I don't mean this from an ego-centered place. I mean it, here we are, we're talking about these things, we live these teachings, is that she had you for a daughter. And the blessing for her, even if you couldn't see it, is that she was around a seeker, a true seeker. And maybe that's what you get to sit with, is that you just sit and pray and keep your energy as high as you can. and know that in ways you can't imagine, let's face it, the mother-daughter relationship's pretty intense, that you're giving her a lot, and feel good about that. That you're talking about your brother having had an assisted suicide, really is what it is. And, you know, last week it was just legalized here in California. I would never do that. I don't think probably many of us in this room would. I think it really does cut from a spiritual level. It takes some of the experience away. I know there are people who feel differently about it. You know, I don't know. I mean, I'm going to try and answer you like I know, but I don't know. But what I feel, that's just, I don't know. I think there's a lot of room karmically and in this divine space that we live in for people genuinely doing things when they're unaware. I mean, genuinely. You know, because really, God watches the heart. And we know that. And so when the heart's in the right place, even if one is ignorant. But, you know, then I know it's going to come up a lot here, and it's a very powerful thing. You see, these are people who don't understand. They think that what they're watching is all that's happening. Suffering will stop it. And, you know, what is suffering in our eyes and in this life is not necessarily suffering to the soul. You know, I'll tell you, this is a really interesting story. When I was in, I lived down in San Diego. We were down there working in that hospital I was telling you about. I was at UCSD taking some courses. And then Master said, go to medical school. I was in a bookstore with my husband. We were just talking, and this man comes up, this big burly man. He said, hey, heard that you're moving to Palo Alto. And I said, yeah. He said, first thing you got to do when you get there, just like this, a total stranger, go to East West Bookstore. I said, okay. He said, yeah, mark my word, he said, go to East West Bookstore. Can you imagine? East West Bookstore, for those of you who don't know, is now in Mountain View, and it's owned by Ananda. I didn't know this. I'd never heard of East West Bookstore. But interestingly, we moved up here. We drove ourselves up. And the next day, we went to East West Bookstore because obviously that man was the next channel. And somehow, it just never dawned on us not to listen to him. So we get up there, and I walk into East West Bookstore, and it's just another whole story that I'm not going to tell, but instantly felt like home. But the book that I bought that day, remember, I was totally unconscious. Totally. I buy a book. I don't remember the name of it. It's been out of print for 30 years at least. That was written by an English barrister. And he writes this book and he says, I was an atheist and I was an avowed atheist and a serious, you couldn't talk about God in front of me. And he and his family, including his son, daughter-in-law, and their two little kids, and his wife and other people, went away on vacation to the sea in England. And on the way home, the father's in a car following the son, daughter-in-law, and two children. That son's car has a head-on collision. Everybody's killed instantly, right in front of the father. And the father was just devastated. He's writing this book now. About 6 months later, somebody knocks on the door and says, I'm here for, I don't remember the son's name now. And the father says, you know, he died. And the woman said, I know, but he's coming to me and he wants me to tell you something. And the father became irate, slammed the door, threw the lady out, but she left her card on the doorstep. And, you know, God only knows why. He picked it up and he kept it. And he called her when he couldn't work through his grief about a year later. And then this woman was a channel and she started telling him things about his son. First of all, she told him a lot of things so that he knew that it was really his son. But the first thing the son said is, Dad, the first thing I want to tell you is that before the accident happened, I was out of my body and I was in a state of pure joy. I watched the accident happen. I need you to know I never suffered. This was not a moment of suffering for me. And I want you to know there are no words for me to tell you how okay I am right now. Isn't that just amazing? So when I say that we don't know what we're looking at, We just have no idea. And what the soul is doing and how it's going to do it and where it is. This man wrote, this was a beautiful book that he wrote. And you can imagine, I had another experience that I'll tell you about because they're telling and compelling. So I had a really, really big practice in Baltimore for a number of years. It was one of the largest practices in the United States, traditional medicine. And I was booked every day, all day. I had 6,000 patients. I mean, 1,500 is big. I had 6,000. This is all real now, not a dream or anything. And there was a woman who came in to see me one day. And she said to me, I was in a car accident like 6 months ago. And they were hit by a drunk driver. And her little girl, she had two daughters with her. She winds up, the mother, comatose in ICU for weeks. When she wakes up, she's told her youngest daughter is dead. And she was just beside herself. The other daughter was okay. I mean, injured, broken bones, but okay. So I just listened to her. And she said to me, somebody told me that if I came to you, that you would help me. And so I said to her, well, I'm willing to listen to you. So she said, I need to hear from her. And I said, well, why don't you pray to her, ask her to come to you if she can, you know, and just hold it like that. I mean, I didn't really know all of what to say to this woman, but I said that. So she would come in to see me every once in a while. I had this very booked schedule. I always left 4 open appointments for urgent care. I would see her name every few months. Worst headache of her life, she would say. Back hurts so much she can't walk. She knows how to get in through my front office. But really, she's just coming. She needed to be near me because I believed her, that her daughter existed somewhere in some state. One day I see her name on my schedule, and she comes in, and she says to me, Shanti, you won't believe it. I said, I think I will. She said she came. She said everybody else would think it's a dream, but I know it's not a dream. And she said, she came to me. Now, they were Jewish. Is anybody else Jewish in here? No. So there's this half, okay. So there's a holiday in the fall called Sukkot, and it's about around the harvest. It's celebrating the harvest, and synagogues are made up. It's beautiful, you know, with all kinds of fall root vegetables, and kids play games, and they march up, and it's a wonderful holiday. This wasn't in the fall. But she said to me, I was in the synagogue, and it was Sukkot, so it's a good feeling. That's what. And she said, and she comes walking down the aisle, and she said to me, Mom, I've been really trying to get to you, but somehow there was something about you that I just couldn't reach you. She said, but I want you to know I'm fine. I was always fine. I love you. I feel very close to you. She just went on and on and on. And they hugged. And she said to her mother, I'm going to have to leave again now. You know. But the woman came in. I mean, so. And I said, what did your husband say? She said, oh, Shanti, I would never tell anybody before I told you. Because she knew her husband, everybody's going to say, oh, yeah, yeah, she needed this so much, she dreamt it. And she said to me, this was not a dream. She came. I mean, very compelling, touching stories now. How did I get her? Why? But really just saying, we don't know. Things look like tragedies, you know? There's a beautiful, beautiful story in the Ramayana, which is this epic writing from which is the Gita. And it's just, it's, you know, it's a story, it's an allegory, everything about the Ramayana is told like that, unlike the Gita, which actually has some facts in it. But there are three men in heaven, and they're talking to their guardian angel, basically, and they don't want to be reborn. They do not want to go back into a human body. But the angel says, look, you had a curse put on you before you died, and the curse said you have to be reborn. So, but I'm going to help you out. I can't lift the curse. Of course, this is a little story. This is now not a true story. But it's told in this deeply spiritual teaching of all of India. So there's a lesson behind it. And I'm going to fix things. Well, in the meantime, on the earth, there's a king. And for years and years and years, he's wanted to marry this most beautiful woman in the whole kingdom. She's been resisting. Finally, she says to him, I'll marry you under one condition. You never question anything, any decision I make. He said, I'll do anything. If that's what you want, I'll do it. So they get married. More than anything, he wants a son. He's a king. He needs a son. They get married. She gets pregnant. She has a son. So the son, the whole kingdom celebrates. 2 weeks later, the woman takes the son down to the river and drowns the son. But the king knows that he can never ask her a question or she'll leave. He can't question anything she does. Now I'm going to fast forward because I don't want the rest of the time to be taken up. Same thing happens with the second son. And with the third son, he says, I can't bear it anymore. You cannot take my son away. And at that point, she takes the son and she leaves and she goes into the woods. And I can't remember now who they become, but they become these high spiritual beings. But why is that story so compelling? I mean, for many reasons. Because what looked like a tragedy on earth, a woman drowning her babies, and it's the point of the story, from the perspective of the soul, it was getting these people into and out of a body very quickly. You don't have to suffer through a human life, but you have to be reborn. That's the curse. So all of it just goes on to say, and now that we're having this talk, or I'm having this talk and you're listening, to be a little more accurate, you'll start seeing it even more in your lives than you did. It's not what things look like. We're living, you know, it never means anything to us when Yogananda says, life is a dream. What does that mean? Oh, it's just a play of light and shadows. The human mind cannot comprehend that. It's impossible. It's true, but it's impossible for us to know. So Yogananda tells the story of a soldier who goes to war, and he fights and he fights in the war, and he thinks he's winning, and he feels so elated. Then all of a sudden, he's shot, and he knows he's dying. And then all of a sudden, he's thinking, I won the battle, but I'm dying, and he's terrified, and he doesn't want to die, and he's in a lot of pain. And then he wakes up, and he's so happy. Oh, my God, that was just a dream, he said. None of that was real. I was never on the battlefield. I didn't win the battle, but I didn't get shot. I didn't die. None of it was real, and he's so happy. But then Yogananda says, when you leave this body, you will remember this is just a dream like that was. It's just like that. When you're dreaming, you don't know it's a dream. It feels real. We don't know this is a dream, but it's a dream. And the only purpose of life, the only purpose, is to allow our soul to make as much progress as it can make, life after life after life. And every single choice that we make, every choice, makes a huge difference about how that'll go for us. Every choice. You're getting ready to sit and meditate, and friends call and say, oh, come on, we just wanted to go out, come and have a glass of wine with us. What do? It's not like going out and having a glass of wine with your friends is bad if you still drink. Not a bad choice, but doesn't get you where staying at home and meditate will. Do you want to go out and sit in a bar and listen to heavy metal, or, you know, have your first and second chakras be garbled all over the place? Or do you want to go to a kirtan at, you know, here? Do you want to take a yoga class? Or, you know, they're not right or wrong or good or bad. And what's good for one person might be really wrong for another person. What's progress to one person might mean losing ground for another person. So there's no judgment here. But you have to ask yourself, next time you want to sit and have a negative thought about somebody, what's that going to do for you? Where is that taking your energy? Never mind that it's affecting the other person. You can't get away from it. Every thought, every action, every movement, we can't make ourselves crazy about this. But it's still the truth that every single thing we're doing is having an impact on our souls. We're not aware of it. We're living in a dream. So the best we can do is do things like this. So we remind ourselves, life is a dream. Time like a stream, Swamiji says, right? Carries our burdens away. Anyway, it's a dream. And we just have to do our best to stay conscious, to pull our energy up the spine, to not let it sink down the spine. Just walking around with our hearts open. You know, Dr. Emoto shows us how much it means to everything in us just coming into prayer pose. Every little thing matters. It's impossible that even this moment is inconsequential. That's a really important point, Pam. I would say to you, you know, definitely if you know, for instance, Sam's daughter. I'm thinking, and I'm with you, I just want to find a passage in here. But if you know Sam's daughter, and you know that you can share this, then this book? Yeah. Well, I just want to read you what one of the very last lines in the Bhagavad Gita. Excuse me. I would like to read it from Krishna rather than say it in my own words. Okay, this is, let me just see if I'm right, if this is the very last stanza. No, but it's very close to the last stanza. I love this reading, not because of what I'm going to read to you, but because of what comes before it, which is so beautiful, where Krishna says, we all know it in a more simple form, that any duty, no matter how high the duty, quits being a duty if it's blocking the unfolding of a higher duty. So, for instance, if no matter what commitment you've made in life, if it's keeping you from advancing spiritually, and Krishna says it beautifully, but what he says here, I'll just read you, I'll read you that stanza too. He says, absorb yourself in me, be wholly devoted to me, worship and bow to me alone, so shall you undoubtedly reach me. This I promise you faithfully, for you are dear to me. So beautiful. Forsaking all other dharmas or duties, right? Remember me alone. I will free you from all sin, even from that of not fulfilling other lesser duties. Do not grieve, he says. So he's saying to Arjuna, everything you have to do in life and that you're grieving about, because after all, Arjuna just had to kill his cousins and he didn't want to do that. And we know that. That's not the point of this talk. But Krishna's saying, don't grieve. This is the very end. He's been espousing all of this wisdom. And then he says, never share these truths with one who is without self-control or devotion, nor with one who won't share with others in a spirit of service, nor give them to one who is indifferent to them or who finds fault with me. Now, that is a really powerful stanza, and we all have to hear that. Krishna is saying to Arjuna, be very careful who you try and share these truths with. Not for two reasons he's saying it. I mean, listen to me, like I know. He's probably saying it for many, but two that are in my mind right now. Number one, when we go to share something with someone who can't hold it where we're holding it, it diminishes it. It just does. It takes something away from it. You know, that's why that woman had to come and tell me that her daughter came to her before she would tell her husband, because she wanted it to be received as truth. And I understood that immediately. The second thing is, we can harm people by trying to share things with them that they're not ready to hear. Because in order to not hear it, and Swamiji says this somewhere, I'm sure, Raghu, you remember this, but Doug, maybe. I mean, people have been teaching this stuff a lot. That when you go to share something with somebody that they're not ready to hear, they have to defend themselves. They have to shut down. They might even act out more. And it could be something as simple like what I was telling you before about my husband. It was not a time for him to hear that he was negative. And it brought out more negativity. And it wasn't his fault. It was my fault. I hope everybody heard me saying that. I wasn't speaking against Barry before. I was showing my own naivete at best and stupidity and selfishness at worst. You know, that was the truth. So this is being recorded. It can be shared with anybody. It's going to be up on AnandaPaloAlto.org website by the middle of next week. But just be mindful, you know, because we're talking about profound things here. We really are. I mean, I'm telling you stories. We can make it seem a little light. But really, trying to say to somebody who's terrified about dying, you know, nothing happens when you die. Nothing happens. You know, that's an affront to certain people. And other things that I've said that we can hear, everybody who's in this room, you all came here. Because, and you know, I said to Master on the way down, I always do, Master, bring whoever there who's perfect. If it's two people or if it's 20 people, just bring whoever's ready to hear this and who will benefit from this. And you speak through me. That's always my prayer before I teach, always. So I know when I'm here, even if somebody in this room has a hard time with something, that it's no accident that you're here. But I'm just saying, just be mindful. Does that make sense? I was saying it out loud more than I didn't say it because I presumed you didn't know. But yeah. Anybody else? Yeah, I'm going to answer you, but let me ask, does anybody else in this room want to answer that? I know you said you've been around a lot of people who have died. Do you? Yeah. I'm just going to repeat this so that the question that was asked is, what have I seen when a soul leaves? Have I actually seen a soul leave the body? And then Brooke shared about her father saying, why are all these kids flying around here right before he died? And that you looked up and you saw a room full of angels. Yeah. He sounds like he didn't recognize them exactly as angels. Maybe he did. Who knows? Yeah. But anyway. Oh, what a great gift you were given to be able to see that. Really, what an amazing. And that somebody else saw it. So that it was corroborated. That's beautiful. That's a great story. You know, it's not always easy. I don't want to say that it's always like that. I just, when I, last April, I gave a class on death and dying in Palo Alto. And one of the women who was there came. It was her first time at Ananda, but she had had a near-death experience. And I'm just looking to see if I wrote her exact words somewhere on here, but I may not be able to find them right now. But she, at the end of the class, she was then willing to share her her final experience. She hadn't shared it throughout class, and I certainly wasn't going to push her. But she said, let me just see. Yeah, this, I wrote it down because I wanted to see if I, because I didn't want to. She said what she felt when she left her body. And she said, I can never find words to say this because, and I know that feeling. You know, it's like, you know, it's just like I said before. I think I said it here. Am I having a deja vu about falling in love? Did I mention that here? If you've fallen in love, you know, you're falling in love, and but you're around somebody who's never been in love. You can't describe what that's like. No matter how many words you use, there is no way to describe that feeling of really falling in love if somebody hasn't experienced it. And I came to know that. Because I worked with addicts and alcoholics. That was my subspecialty in medicine a lot. And early on, I would try and say, oh, but if you get clean and sober, you're going to be able to love and be loved. And they would just look at me. They had no idea what it meant. None. And I realized I had to quit using words and start helping them experience their heart opening. So that's what she was saying about this. She was saying, I'm going to say these words. But she said when she left her body, she felt instant relief. She said a relief that was so like knowing in a moment it was everything you always wanted. And there it was, but it wasn't about anything. It wasn't like something was handed to you. And then she said, I felt an absolute unconditional acceptance of every aspect of my being. That touched me so deeply. And it reminded me of when Swami Kriyananda says, you know, he says, I look out at you. He's talking to a big crowd of us. And he said, you're going to get it someday. Why not now? I mean, the way a parent so much wants to just say to children, like, you can be free now. You can be happy. You don't have to worry that that little girl called you a bad name or whatever it is. You know, you're going to get there anyway. And why not now? And when I read that, I thought to myself, and when she said that to me, I thought, wow, unconditional, complete acceptance of every aspect of my being. Isn't that an amazing thing to imagine? You know, I mean, it's a really remarkable, you know, I don't know about anybody else, but I always wonder what are the lessons my soul's going to learn in this life, this time. And I've shared with you about unconditional love and a huge lesson about thinking, I mean, in this case, it was lust, but it doesn't matter that something in the material plane would make me happy. But just about 6 or 8 weeks ago, I had an experience with somebody who's very important to me where I was sort of saying to myself, it's really clear to me that they don't like me. I've known it for a long time, but I said it's just something about me. Just, it's like energy that's dissonant. And then the thought came to me, but I didn't get emotional about it. I mean, I really did not get emotional. And then the thought, which was the first time because I've been wanting this person to like me for a long time. And then the thought came to me, you know, what you two share is so meaningful. You can always come together to serve other people spiritually. That was so, I mean, we've done that a lot over many, many, many years. But I always feel like they don't like me. But still we come together and we serve. And it just came to me that it was totally okay that I did not need this person to like me. And I saw how much in my life had been geared towards how much I needed people to like me. You know, just, I would never have said exactly that before. I mean, people look at me in life, they consider me an independent spirit and all these things, but I know deep down, you know, and I could go back and back having to do with the family I chose and my mother who was so judgmental and blah, blah, blah. I mean, everything in it, the psychological, I could trace that. But I was suddenly free from it. And I knew in that moment that something karmically had transpired. And so a little while ago, I had to meet with another person who just, I mean, I really think this, she just has a thing for me, I don't know why, really a negative thing. And we were having a talk, and many of our talks start, she always throws a barb at me. She starts the talk by, every time we get together, by telling me something that's wrong with me, and or something that I'm doing wrong. And she just does it, I don't want to be very specific because I don't want it out there, but in an offhanded way, and just keeps moving on like, it wouldn't have any effect on me. And I actually think sometimes the people who don't realize their own power can never really get that they have enough power to actually hurt you with their words or their actions. They don't even know it because they don't feel powerful enough within themselves. But this happened, and for the first time, and I've never responded out loud to it, but it's always been like, ouch, you know, just each time, and I sort of steel myself for it whenever we're going to get together. But this time I didn't. And this time when she did her thing and she said her thing, which was particularly cutting, I said to myself, I mean, I didn't even say anything. I realized it did not have an impact on me and that I was able to keep my heart wide open and love her and bring her what she needed. And the reason I'm saying it, it was so relieving. It was so unbelievably relieving to not be attached to what she thought of me and to not, and it's not that I needed to say to myself, oh, this poor woman, she this, she that. I didn't say any of it. I didn't have to put her down. I didn't have to, I just could move through it. When I heard this line, unconditional acceptance of every aspect of my being, that's what it reminds. Now, I'm not there. I'm telling you about steps along the way. But I'm saying that's what we feel when we're free. That's why your father could click his heels. I don't think, you know, Swami, I listened to a talk Swami gave. It was death. I forget what it was, but it was not exactly on this topic. I listened to it 2 days ago as I was driving in preparation for this. And much of it I couldn't translate to today. But he said in there that when souls leave, that it can be, if you've lived your life not spiritually open, or if at the last minute you're not open, that leaving can be very confusing. And that, you know, you don't leave in a good way. It's not an automatic thing that when you're free of this body, you go to some high, they're called lokas in Sanskrit, like where souls go. All souls do not go to one place. And he said, and that soul can live in confusion for a long time till it takes another body. And, you know, it might even choose to have a body that, a family, a life that's going to be utterly confusing. And then that person will be saying, man, why am I in this family? Look at these parents. Or, you know, again, till we're able to learn. But I don't want to stand here and say that I think passing is always a beautiful thing. Asha told a very beautiful, interesting story at a talk she gave at East West on death and dying. Just, I don't know when it was, a few weeks ago, Nancy, you were there, whenever it was. She told a story that I've heard her tell before about a woman who committed suicide. And she went, her soul went to a very dark place. I mean, unlit, no windows. Everybody, all the beings there were dressed in dark clothes. And she said everybody was looking down all the time. And it hit her. Whoa, look at what I've done. I mean, I committed suicide, which is not a good thing, and I brought myself here. And then this woman wrote a book, it was an article from Reader's Digest. That's what it was. And I wasn't at this talk, but I've heard Asha tell this story before. And she said, and the woman, suddenly something made her decide to look up. And when she looked up, she saw all these angels that were making such an effort or putting out so much energy that they wanted to help these beings. But these beings were always looking down. And this woman saw that if she would look up, remember she'd committed suicide from depression, that if she could even force herself to look towards the light, that there would be enormous help there for her. And she did, and she came back. This was an out-of-body experience. So she is alive, and she wrote this article. I'm saying it because, a number of reasons, how important it is to, that's what free will is. Which direction do we turn with every decision? Do we look towards the light or away from it? Do we solve our problems in the direction of God or in the direction of ego? That's the free will that we've been given as human beings. But in this instance, also, that every death is not this lovely kicking our heels, you know, I never felt anything, Dad or Mom, I was perfectly free. You know, that I think leaving can be challenging if we don't live consciously. You know, living consciously is so important, really. Asking questions like, why is this happening in my life right now? What's here for me in this circumstance, in this? And when we start feeling whatever, jealousy, hurt, greed, to really consciously choose to express an opposite and antidotal, as in an antidote to something. So if you're feeling rage at somebody, what does it mean to open your heart and practice loving them? Practice loving them. Not only will it help them, but it makes all the difference in the world what happens from your soul level, you know, with anger. When you're feeling selfish or greedy, how can you serve somebody? You can solve almost every spiritual problem in the world by serving somebody or serving a high cause or giving of yourself, nishkam karma, without regard for the fruits of your labor, you know. And these things matter. These aren't just words that we hear. They matter. So none of us are getting it perfectly. Obviously, that's why we're here. But we can keep trying. I asked you and then I didn't listen. Did you want to say anything? Well, you know, we're not all going to attain sainthood in this life, and I think, you know, really what you're saying is very right, and we get to, we get to live with these things, but we can do our best is all we can do. In a better place? Can anybody help you? Well, you know, I'm going to say to you, I don't know the answer to that question, but It seems to me, from everything I do know, that I would say absolutely. I think, you know, you mentioned forgiveness. Let me just think of how I want to say what I want to say to you. I think if there are souls rooting for us, it matters a great deal. And I think it not only matters to the person, but to the soul that's departed. I have encouraged many, many, many people to practice forgiveness. Really practice it. You know, my mother was a very, very, what do I want to say about her? She was a troubled soul. She was not a good mother. In this day and age, she would have been called abusive. In that day and age, she was not. She never beat me, but she sort of systematically taught me that I was fat, that I was ugly, that I was stupid. I mean, all four of the kids. And when I turned 35, it came to me. Now, she was still alive, but that I had to forgive my mother, that it was killing me, and it was going to dictate the rest of my life and kill me. So I started practicing forgiveness. It took me a year, 1 year. Every day I prayed about it. I did affirmations about it. I went to conferences on it, workshops. I read books on it. This is true. And one morning I woke up, and I woke up my husband. I said, "You won't believe it." He said, "What?" I said, "I have forgiven my mother." He said, "Are you sure?" And I said, "Yes, I'm certain. I feel it." And I want to say to you, now she was still in her body. My mother changed from that day on. She really did. She became much more loving. I mean, I'm saying to you, honestly, from that day on, the day that the realization came to me. So I think, you know, because it's a soul, it just seems to me that if you've hurt somebody or if you've held bad feelings or even if you know they've done wrong, that if you can forgive them, if you can hold them in your heart, if you can hold them up in love, that's got to be a great spiritual boon for them. I can't give you any data. I wish. Yeah. I don't think it's the starting of the charity and the money. I think it's the intention. You know, Yogananda. No, the person who's passed, right? Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. Even though my mother was in her body, I don't know that it matters so much because I was now dealing on a soul level, not on an emotional. And I think, you know, one of the things that Yogananda said over and over in so many ways, Krishna says it in the Gita over and over. I mean, Jesus said it. Everybody said it. I guess I'm realizing that God watches the heart, that it's our intentions. Now, it's often being said for us if our heart's in the right place, even if we can't accomplish something, that's good. But, you know, we have shared karma with a lot of people. We came in for that reason. We've chosen certain groups to come in with. You know, I mean, I was born and raised Jewish, and I share a lot culturally with those people. And I feel, I'm pretty sure I lived during the Holocaust anyway, but I mean, it touches me deeply, the Holocaust, everything about it. So I just feel like if there's somebody you really care about and they die, you can't say, okay, just to make them better, I'm going to start a charity. But if your heart's in the right place with it, and you say, I'm going to honor the soul of that person, and you mean it, I think it affects because it's energy. And it's no energy can go not experienced or transmitted. And again, I can't speak from a real knowledge, but I believe that. I want to say that whatever good thoughts we can send, even to people who have passed on, certainly it helps us, but I think it helps them. You know, I want to just say, because I'm saying to myself, I'm saying out loud, I don't really know, but I feel like we do know. I feel like it's the essence of what I've been saying. Energy changes form, but it's still energy. And it just seems virtually impossible to me. These children coming back and telling their parents, don't worry about me, being able to connect with them. I just can't believe that we're not having any impact in these other astral planes. I want to say it seriously, that we can help people in whatever platform there. And my sister died, I told you, when she was 42. I was 30. She died, I mean, it's well over 30 years ago. But I pray for her and to her all the time. Why would we do that otherwise? And I often say to myself, God, she's probably been back three times since then. You know, she might be the next person who's driving you crazy, Shanti, or whatever. But, I mean, still, I really want to say that in a very positive and hopeful way, that I think that praying for departed souls matters. You know, there, I was thinking about it this morning when I was jotting down some thoughts. You know, and this has more to do with the connection of people. The forms can change. You know, one life somebody might be your husband, the next time they might be your daughter. I mean, form and gender could change, all of that. I remember when I separated from that first husband who I was decided to become a doctor with and all that, we separated before he died. But I remember about 2 years after we separated, I went back to him and I said to him, you have to forgive me. He said, I do. I said, no, you don't. I feel you don't. And you have to, Barry, because we're not married, but we're still in the same love. I said, I know this to be true. So what we need to do is find another form for that love. It was so real to me. And he heard that. And we went on to become, I mean, I moved in and lived with him the whole last year that he died and helped him die. And I mean, we let that love manifest in other ways. See, I don't think that these bodies make that much of a difference. So I'm saying these things to you about things I've done with people who are alive, but I don't think it matters that they've passed. I would love for all of us to know how deeply we can pray for. You know, there's an article, I cannot recall it right now, but I wish I could, in one of the trilogy of books that SRF puts out that are Yogananda's, The Divine Romance and Man's Eternal Quest, and there's one more. There's one of his talks is on how you can, in fact, this just came to my mind, so I'm glad I remembered it. How can you contact departed souls? And I'm just saying it's out there as a reference because I know that it's possible. And it's not just contacting it, but and I remember I've read it, but not for years, that definitely we can do that. And Yogananda wrote about it there. I hope I can say this to you in a way that makes sense. I know it to be true, but I hope I can find the words. I'm praying for the right words. You cannot solve spiritual problems on the material/emotional plane. What we're talking about here is soul consciousness, is soul progression, is what's best for the soul, what's right for the soul. What can we do that's going to help our soul make the most progress? If you ask me, can I ever imagine that somebody wanted to kill themselves? Of course I can. If you ask me, can I ever imagine that somebody who has very little or no spiritual understanding of the world thinks, I'm just going to get out of this suffering? Of course, I understand that. But they don't get out of anything. What happens when you commit suicide is you just get to come back and learn whatever your soul needed to learn to move forward. You will not neutralize it by committing suicide. In fact, you probably lose a little bit of spiritual ground because you've taken your energy down in your chakras. You've taken it in and down. Me, me, me. I'm in pain. I'm worried. I'm depressed. I'm this. That is not a spiritual way. That's not a way to grow spiritually. So, because your mind can understand it, one's mind can understand, all that means is that's the degree to which we are holding on to likes and dislikes and emotions. That's the contractive emotional part of the heart chakra. The expansive, loving part and neutralizing energy in the heart chakra to allow it to move up. It's a little linear for what it really is, but to allow it to move spiritually is beyond likes and dislikes. It's not emotionally reacting to things. It's seeing what will set the soul to soar. So when you ask me a question, totally understandable, where your emotions are so involved, there's no answer that I'm going to give to you that's going to solve those emotions, because people are in pain, physical pain, emotional pain, psychic pain, spiritual pain. But what the talk that we're having here is we're having a spiritual discussion. We're saying, how do we help the soul? How do we live in such a way that will help the soul find its true home back at one with the superconscious divine entity? Suicide will not do that. Will it relieve the pain for the moment? We think so, because those of us who are watching, looks like that body's now dead and not in pain. But I'm already telling you that it's nothing to do with what happens with the soul. That I do know for sure. So, and I just told you about this woman who committed suicide, who went to this dark, horrible, gray, people looking down, couldn't breathe kind of place. So it doesn't solve the problem. It doesn't do what people think it's going to do when they're just reacting with their emotions. So it is, God knows what has to happen with us. And when I say God knows, it's not like God is other. We have a whole pattern of energy set into motion, lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, that will draw to us exactly what we need. There's nobody else. I've had so many people say to me, how can I believe in a God that would have given me this childhood that I had? How could I believe in a God that would allow this to happen? But it's not like there's some other being doing that. We've created that with our own magnetism. That's the point. And the only way we're going to get out of it is by neutralizing all of these things. That's the only way energy can come back up the astral spine. And if you don't understand it now, it doesn't matter. It's still the truth. It's like what I was trying to say about the scientists before. They could get within a lepton's close worth of understanding of what's happening spiritually, but they won't. Well, you know, in a way, what you're wrestling with is, I agree with that, by the way. I mean, what do you know and why would you do that? That doesn't help her. What you could do is just, oh, there's a soul who's in trouble. I'm going to pray for them. Then it's not judgment. Then it's non-attachment. So we're talking about big spiritual lessons here, but because they're big and hard doesn't make them any less important. So I agree with you. You shouldn't judge her one way or the other. I'm saying to you, suicide never helps the soul. But I'm not saying to you, and on the other side, I would say to you, everything's karma. That's what she was destined to do. She's got as many lifetimes as she needs to come back. I mean that literally. Yogananda says we come back millions of times before we attain enlightenment. So she'll just keep coming back. She'll have to live with that. You know, I'm well aware. I wanted to tell you one more story, but it's 1:30 and I feel a little badly keeping everybody here. So let me not tell the story. Let me exercise self-control here. And if anybody needs to get up and leave, please feel free to do it. But this is a story that Bharat, he didn't tell this story. This is a visualization that he used that I heard through somebody else. Bharat's a man up in Ananda Village, a very wise and highly evolved soul. And he said, he was teaching a class on karma, and he said, the next time in your life that something comes to you, that the way we all do, like you either feel unjustly treated or you're mad that it's happening or you're in that, why does this have to happen to me place? Sounds silly in the context of this class, but let's face it, even yesterday probably most of us had a thought like that. He said, no matter what it is that you're wondering why it's in your life, he said, I want you to imagine God in a human form as you would imagine God. So he said, for most of you, it'll be a woman with long blonde hair and in either blue or purple robes with some gold on it. And it's true, like this divine entity, beautiful. And imagine this being, however you imagine it, coming towards you, just looking at you from a distance. You just feel her engaged with you. As she gets closer, I'm saying it in the she, but as she gets closer, you start to see her eyes and you realize that you have never felt such love from anybody in this life. She's looking at you with more love than you could have ever imagined. And then you realize that she's carrying something. And the closer that she gets, you realize that she's carrying an absolutely exquisite, solid gold tray. And she's coming towards you as if with all this love that she's going to offer it to you. And when she gets right up next to you, what is on that tray that she's giving you is exactly what you just thought didn't belong in your life. And it's just such a beautiful visualization. It just says, here's Divine Mother offering you exactly what you need to grow, because there can't be a mistake about it. And you know, it's helped me many times when I've wanted to act out a little bit, and I remember that. So, but what you're saying is, but then I went to judgment, and I would say to you, of course you can't go to judgment. How do we know that person's life or that person's soul? And that's really the whole point of so much of what has been said today, is non-judgment, acceptance. But you can't just take these lessons, these words, this wisdom from the Gita, from anywhere, and think that it's going to work in the everyday world where people are just trying to make some money, make some friends, control their children, control their parents. Won't work there. They work when we apply them spiritually. They work when we're seriously committed to finding God. And they work with 100% of the time when that's our intention, not if we're using them for any other purpose. So when I give a sermon on Sunday, I'm often looking out there. I know a lot of those people. And I can just imagine, it's going through my mind as I'm speaking, how they're going to use it to get away with something, whatever I'm saying. A few weeks ago, I had to give a sermon on why everybody's karma is different and we can never judge anybody, by anything else. Anyway, it was a whole sermon and it was well said. But I thought, okay, a lot of people are going to say, see, I told you I'm not supposed to meditate, or I told you this, or I told you that. No, that's not the point. We can only understand things where we are. That's exactly right and very well said. She didn't go there because anybody was punishing her. Energetically, it's just where she was. So, yeah. Okay, everybody, I feel like I need to stop. Thank you all so much, really.